Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a petroleum engineer's view of the Deepwater Horizon disaster. It was April 20th, 2010, when BP's Macondo blowout occurred. 11 rig workers were killed. The half-billion-dollar Deepwater Horizon drilling rig burned and sank in a mile of water in the Gulf of Mexico. And the well blew for 86 days, spilling 5 million barrels of oil into the Gulf, one of the most lethal man-made environmental disasters in U.S. history. Even today, BP's civil trial continues in New Orleans. My guest, John Turley, spent a career in the energy industry as a petroleum engineer and energy executive for Phillips Petroleum, Tenneco, and Marathon Oil. After his retirement, he began writing mystery novels. But the April 2010 blowout in the Gulf renewed his interest in the oil industry, and he writes that the Deepwater Horizon accident was not a result of the inherent dangers of deepwater drilling, but rather an incident of mistakes and misjudgments that never should have occurred, and if the lessons of the disaster are learned, should never happen again. He's the author of The Simple Truth, BP's Macondo Blowout, and he'll be giving the Hewlings Lecture for the University of Tulsa's College of Engineering and Natural Sciences on Friday, November 15th at 6 o'clock at the Alan Chapman Activity Center. John Turley is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. John Turley, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
You've written in your book, The Simple Truth, that it's important to know why the Deepwater Horizon accident actually occurred, how it was preventable, and why its lessons need to be learned. When we think of something like this huge blowout, we think of it being a whole lot of complex systems. Was the accident imminently preventable?
Absolutely preventable. And that's the whole message I'm trying to get across. You know, I talk to schools and faculty, petroleum engineering students, and people in the industry to tell them that this is not a matter of the technology being too demanding or the water being too deep or pressures and temperatures being too high. This is absolutely basic petroleum engineering and operating fundamentals. And that's what's so sad about it, is if you go through this step by step and you think, you look at any one step and you say, gosh, there's not one single differential equation involved here. There are no massive calculations. It's just plain and simple day-to-day operations. And these are the things you would normally expect to happen. And let's look at the data and see what happens. And we look at that and we say, well, yeah, based on that, there's a problem. But for some reason, they didn't respond to that data as if there were a problem. They responded to that data by just taking a next step. And so, yes, absolutely preventable, and that's the sad thing about it.
Is deep water drilling inherently more risky than, say, shallow water drilling, or is it really, do all the deep water and all the pressure make that much difference?
You know, that's a very good question, Rich, and the demarcation is primarily this. We use a humongous piece of equipment called a blowout preventer. And that blowout preventer, for example, for the Macondo well is 450 tons. It's 55 feet tall, so a five-and-a-half-story building, six-story building tall. And in shallow water operations, you can walk up to the BOP, so to speak. I mean, it's literally underneath the rig floor. In deep water operations, that same blowout preventer is on the seafloor. So, for example, in Macondo, where we're drilling in a mile of water, the blow-up preventer is not something you can walk up to and touch and even look at. It's setting a mile below you on the seafloor. So it means that everything you do with the blow-up preventer is by remote control. And when you do take an action with the blow-up preventer a mile away, it means anything between the blow-up preventer and where you are up on the rig floor is still alive and well. So it's kind of like a safety valve being a mile away from you, so you could still have a problem, and the safety valve is so far away you don't even know it's been actioned. So yeah, that's the demarcation, is primarily the location of the blow-up preventers. As far as pressures and temperatures, those things, the depth of the Macondo well was right at 3.5 miles, a little 18,000 feet. And I can remember in the 70s, you know, drilling 18, 19, 20,000-foot wells, very, very high pressure. In fact, higher pressure than Macondo. So the pressure of the oil and gas that you're looking for is not necessarily higher than it might be in shallow water. In fact, it can be less than as it is for Macondo. So that blow-up preventer being on the seafloor is the primary difference.
And, of course, that was the big piece of equipment that seemingly failed, or did it? Was that the biggest cause of the accident?
You know, that's a good question, and I'm so glad you broached it. It's something that I cover extensively in my presentation, and it's this. I use an example in my presentation that I call the Thelma and Louise example. It's if, in fact, you're driving a car down the interstate at 70 miles an hour and you come over a hill and you see an accident farther down the road, well, you put on your brakes and you stop and you stay out of trouble. If the accident is too close to you when you come over the hill, you could have to slam on your brakes to keep from hitting it. Think about Thelma and Louise. You cannot wait until you're over the Grand Canyon until you hit the brakes. You cannot be in midair over the Grand Canyon. And that's kind of what they did on Macondo. There was a problem that existed as early as 6 o'clock in the evening, and that problem was absolutely fixable. In fact, they were running some tests to see whether or not they had a problem that had to be fixed. And the data actually said, yes, there is a problem. But they allowed that problem to manifest for so many hours, 3 hours, almost 4 hours, such that when the well actually started producing oil and gas and they did not see it, the oil and gas basically filled up the well and got to the surface, got up to the rig before they actually knew it was coming. And by the time it did, it was flowing so hard and so fast. I use another example I call the Mentos Diet Coke. You know the experiment where you see these kids stick a roll of Mentos down in a 2-liter bottle of Diet Coke and it'll, you know, go two stories high?
Right.
Well, think about that same kind of phenomena coming out of the big, we call it a drilling riser, or the riser that connects the rig up there at sea level to the blow-up preventer a mile below, and this thing is 21 inches around. So instead of a 2-liter bottle of Diet Coke, we've got a 21-inch pipe a mile long filled with rapidly expanding oil and gas, just like that Mentos Diet Coke experiment. And here it comes, and after it was fully blowing and going, that's when they closed the blow-up preventers. And that's equivalent to waiting till you're over the Grand Canyon to step on the brakes.
Or closing the barn door after the cattle are out.
Absolutely. And letting it flow so hard and so fast that as these blow-up preventers, these purpose-built blow-up preventers, are shrinking and collapsing and closing in around that pipe to do the job they're supposed to do, that fluid is moving so fast, it just ate the drill pipe, literally shredded the steel pipe because it's moving so fast. So it kind of took away the ability of the blow-up preventers to do their job. So I hold these blow-up preventers in high esteem, and I say they waited way too late, and the blow-up preventers did as good a job as they could under those circumstances. And I cannot give you another example in oil field history where we allowed a well to flow so hard so long before
we closed the blow-up. It's interesting because in the very first page of your book, you have a picture of the Spindletop Discovery well in Beaumont. And of course, that's one of the classic oil derricks where the oil is gushing out of the top. Was it like that? I mean, is that an apt comparison?
In fact, that's why I use that Spindletop picture, because if you can imagine, you know, that was a fairly benign blowout, because in those days, they didn't know how to stop it. So they just drilled until here it came, and then they worried about how to stop it. You know, some of those wells, the early on wells, they dug big pits around the derrick, so that as it blew oil and gas, it would go into the pit, and then they would suck the production out of the pit. So, I mean, they didn't know what to do.
Right.
So it was things like Spindletop that said, you know, guys, when we drill these wells, we need a valve mechanism that we can close when we do get this flow, and then maybe we can kind of control the flow of oil and gas. Well, that was a rapidly evolving technology that turned into blowout preventers. That's what they are. And it's a set of valves that allow you to control pressures in the well. So Spindletop was a good example, but, oh, yeah, can you imagine the same thing? Now, Macondo, you got to have to imagine a Spindletop. You were probably looking at a derrick that was 30 or 35 feet tall. When Macondo blew out, it blew out over it was 75 feet from the water up to the rig floor, then another 244 feet to the top of the derrick, and it blew over the derrick. So it was one heck of a scene, and credit to those guys who ultimately died a very few minutes later. They closed the blow-up preventers exactly as they were supposed to do.
But I guess the failure was in not realizing they had struck oil?
No. That's a very fair question. Actually, the sequence of events, very simply, was this. BP made a discovery, and that discovery was a good discovery. And it was, like I say, about 3.5 miles below sea level. So they knew they had oil and gas. Their job was to secure the well with steel casing and with cement and with heavy mud to such extent they knew it was perfectly safe in the condition they left it, because what they're going to do is release the rig to go work on another well while the Macondo well sets there safe and secure, full of casing and cement and heavy mud. So the design team from BP can physically design and build the massive subsea facilities they would need to install in the next 2, 3, or 4 years, while in fact they drill additional wells in the area, demarcation for how big is this oil field. We know in the well we drilled, it's about 200 feet thick. The pay zone is about 200 feet thick. But now we need to really define the lateral area of how big this area is, so we know, is this a 50 million barrel field, 100 million barrel field, or a billion barrel field? And depending on, we call those delineation wells, depending on what the delineation wells find, would further define the kind of subsea facilities they need to produce oil and gas in a mile of water. So BP had made a discovery. All they wanted to do is secure it to such extent they could release the rig and come back in 2 or 3 years.
I see.
During that process of securing the well is when things went wrong.
And as the presidential reports and many other reports have detailed, there was a whole lot of things that went wrong in the course of securing that well. Were the people in charge of the rig under a lot of financial pressures to get this thing done? Because as you write in your book, this was a project that was a couple years. They'd started drilling before when a tropical storm basically caused damage to the original rig, which I believe was the Marianas, Transocean
right.
Marianas. And so they had to abandon this. So this was probably over budget and delayed. Was there a lot of pressure from that front to get this thing done?
Yes, and I think that's one of the things that, you know, is being brought out by the U.S. Coast Guard depositions, by the trials, and even the media, basically addressing the fact that these wells aren't cheap. If this well had been drilled according to plan, it would have been about a $90 million well. Well, it didn't go quite to plan. Some things were slow. Like you say, they started off with the Marianas in late 2009, October, November 2009. And in November, here comes a Hurricane Ida, which got rid of the Marianas for them. It went to a shipyard, never came back, and they replaced it with a Deepwater Horizon. So now we've had some delay because of all that. In fact, a couple months delay because of that. And a lot of these leases that operators pick up from the Minerals Management Services, the MMS, which has now been renamed and regrouped into a different regulatory authority called the Bureau of Offshore Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement, BOEMERE, they've got a target now of $90 million to drill this well, and they also have some obligations to this Minerals Management Service to release the rig, or actually to get to another location by a given date. All these leases have calendar lease periods associated with them, and you have obligations to commence work and to finish work on certain projects by certain dates. So here's the Deepwater Horizon. It's on the Macondo well, but it's got a clock ticking that says you really need to get off by so-and-so a date because you've got an obligation on another well you've got to get to. So not only then are we have a clock driving us, but the $90 million is long gone. Now we're at $100 million, $110, $120, $140 million. And the days are ticking on. So now we're in April. We've made this discovery. And so it's a great feeling of satisfaction when an exploration well actually finds oil and gas. And this was a significant discovery. So it's a very, very good feeling. But that euphoria goes away rapidly. We say, okay, guys, the fun's over. Now secure this well. Let's get back to business. You know, we don't need to spend another $100 million just finishing this well. Let's just get off it and get on to the next project. So in that wind-down phase of the Macondo well, in preparing it for what we call temporary abandonment, everybody's feeling the pressure of get this well secured, quit spending $1 million a day and get off this well and get on to the next one. And I have to say, from the executive management perspective, they feel the dollars a lot more than the guys on the rig do. The guy on the rig, you know, he has to add up the daily cost every day and call it in and all that kind of good stuff. And he gets to see what the daily cost is. But it's not like he runs around all day saying, oh, my gosh, I've got to cut costs. I've got to shave corners. I've got to take shortcuts. That's not the feeling at all on the rig. That is more the management, executive management. But, yes, BP was under pressure to cut this cost and get on to the next well.
My guest today is John Turley, a retired petroleum engineer and energy executive. He's also a writer and has written mysteries, but his latest book is titled The Simple Truth, BP's Macondo Blowout. And he'll give the Hewlings Lecture Friday, November 15th at the University of Tulsa for the College of Engineering and Natural Sciences at 6 o'clock in the Alan Chapman Activity Center. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. In that close down of the well, when this disaster happened, were there shortcuts taken, or was it a matter of negligence to these building up problems, the fact that this thing was getting ready to blow and people were not noticing it?
Very fair question. And certainly the gist of my presentation is the physical steps that were taken and, you know, was in fact a given step a shortcut. One of the things I have not done in my book is target individual names and faces of people out there who had given responsibilities. But from assessing the data, there are certain sequences of logic that would be standard industry practices, standard safety practices, and operational procedures to say, when you have A, B, C, D should follow. And so if they have A, B, C, and X follows, and that's in the data, I don't know the person's mindset when they made the decision to go to X, but I think, gosh, that just doesn't seem right. I mean, are they looking for a shortcut here? Are they trying to make something happen faster? You know, one of the things that does make you, make me, I'll put it on my shoulders, make me concerned is that there are certain steps that should be taken that add levels of security and levels of safety to the procedures they were going through. They, in fact, showed in their plans that they had those steps to be taken. But the argument could be made, guys, I think you should have taken that step way back here in the procedure as opposed to waiting as late as you plan it in the procedure. And with all the whys and wherefores of, you know, for example, when they finished this well and they ran the casing and they filled it full of cement, their next job was to test and make sure there were no leaks in the casing from the inside out and no leaks in the casing from the outside in. Well, one of the things they could have done that would absolutely have almost squashed the risk of a leak from the outside in, let's put some more cement in the well. They run some pipe down inside the big casing that they've just installed, and they pump some liquefied cement, 200 or 300 feet of it, so imagine a patio 200 or 300 feet thick, in the bottom of the well, and they just let it sit there and harden, and nothing's going to leak from the outside in, period. Now they can go through all the tests, the formal tests they have to go through to prove to the Minerals Management Services in those days that there's no leak from the outside in, and they're not going to find any. They just put 300 feet of cement down there. But their procedure actually called for installing that 300 feet of cement much later in the program, and the well actually got away from them before they got to that step. So you can't really say it was a shortcut because either way would have taken them the same amount of time, but to move it later in the program kind of bypassed a safety opportunity they could have had early on. So you can't really say they're shortcuts, but they're procedural differences where practices, standard industry practices, API recommended practices might have said do certain steps otherwise.
Hmm. What are the lessons of the Macondo blowout of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill? One of the first steps that happened in the wake of this accident was we basically shut down deep water drilling for, and I think the immediate reaction from Washington was this is inherently riskier. Has that attitude changed, in your opinion, over the last few years as the reports and the more evidence of what actually occurred on the rig have come to light?
Absolutely a critical question. There was a one of the investigative reports came out called the President's Commission, and in that report it said basically the Macondo incident was an indictment against the entire industry relative to complacency and safety culture. And I about had a heart attack when I read that. I thought, I spent my entire career, my colleagues just spent their entire careers. We go out there, we don't want to die. We're not bad guys. We're not trying to do bad things. There's no evil in all this. We're absolutely trying to do this work in such a way, in the spirit of engineering ethics, where, you know, you're looking at productivity and safety and environmental stewardship and cost for sure, and you really want these things to happen. But for an official investigative report to come out to say this is an indictment against the complacency and safety culture of the entire industry, you know, that's one of the things I take to petroleum, like the University of Tulsa. You know, I talk to petroleum engineers about that. I say, guys, that's an indictment against you, and you haven't even graduated yet. Are you going to take that? Are you going to sit back and say, I'm going to fall into a spirit of a safety culture that allows complacency to such extent my life's at risk? No, you're not going to do that. So I think that was the initial shock, political, media, certainly throughout the Gulf Coast, and anywhere there's oil and gas production is, holy cow, how can something like this happen? I mean, are these guys just out there throwing their arms in the air and say, gee, that was sure, you know, we didn't know that was going to happen.
Well, let me stop you for a second. If it's not the industry, was it BP? Because, you know, BP, this was the second big disaster within that decade. I can think of the Alaska oil pipeline in Prudhoe Bay, where it turns out that they hadn't even run a corrosion pig on a section of pipeline in like 16 years. and the pipe corroded and they spilled 200,000 barrels of oil in Prudhoe Bay.
That was truly, you know, one of BP's claims to ominous fame, Texas City Refinery, those kinds of things, a fire there. And that was one of the original attacks relative to Macondo, both politically and in the media, was BP apparently has a safety culture that allows these big bad problems to happen. And let me put just a little bit different spin on it. I absolutely avoided addressing BP's safety culture in this spirit. I worked for Marathon Oil. Marathon Oil is a big company. It was the fourth largest U.S.-based oil and gas company in the years as I retired. So, pretty big company. BP's 50 times bigger than Marathon. Therefore, they have 50 times more projects. Therefore, they have 50 times the chance of something going wrong on a given problem. So great big entities like BP, like Exxon, are going to be exposed to a lot of things. But statistically, it does seem that BP has more than their fair share. I think that's a fair statement.
Let me ask you another question. You know, we've had a revamp of the Mineral Management Service in the wake of this disaster. Would more regulations have made a difference? If there were more inspectors at the time, would that have made a difference? Because, of course, that was all part of the press coverage in the immediate aftermath. What's your sense?
You know,
given that you are a former petroleum engineer and regulation means more work.
You know, it does. But I can remember my days when I was physically offshore on a rig and an inspector would come. And I was just a person. The guy who came out there was just a person. And we would talk, and we both had the same goals. We don't want things to go wrong. There are certain rules and regulations we had to follow. And he might look over my shoulder and make sure I'm filling out so-and-so report. And he might go around and ask some people some questions. But as I will call him a third party. As a third party landing on a rig any time during the day to try to get a feel for the entity as a whole is a major challenge. And I can't imagine what it would be like for an inspector to land on a complex facility like the Deepwater Horizon and try to get a feel for what's happening on a day-to-day basis. And let me give you an example of why it's so difficult to nest yourself as an inspector into something like the last day of the Macondo well and to get enough sense of what's going on that you might have made a difference. It just so happened on the day of the blowout, absolutely coincidental, that four people arrived on that rig that aren't normally out there. Two were BP vice presidents. Two others were Transocean vice presidents. They came out there for kind of a day on the rig tour. And there were days when I was the vice president, and I used to go spend a day on a rig, you know, just talk to people, chat them up, be friendly. but I'm not getting in their hair. I'm not trying to run their business for them. And now think of this. Those four guys were out there when all of this was happening, and they never saw it. So an inspector, had it been those four vice presidents and an inspector, I have to believe the inspector would have had just as much difficulty trying to take a spot look at data charts and say, oh my gosh, that's a problem, shut this well down. I just don't think that would have happened. So in fairness to your question, do we need more regulations and inspectors? Absolutely. They don't hurt our business in any way, shape, or form. And there's a lot more going on in industry than just the regulatory side. From the regulation side, they have a system called SEMS, Safety and Environmental Management Systems. And that is a concerted effort on the government's part to make sure they're doing their part to make sure that given regulations are being followed, and that if, for example, a company like BP or like Marathon or like Chevron has safety regulations internal, that at least the guys in the rig are abiding by the company's safety regulations, which are probably much more onerous than the government's.
One last question. What is the industry's takeaway from the Deepwater Horizon oil spill? Is it has it changed fundamentally the way the industry looks at its standard procedures, specialized procedures for deep water drilling? What exactly?
Very good question. The things that I see, you know, I will say that as one tiny little part, you know, my making these presentations, my being invited to make these presentations by the Chevrons and the Murphy Oils and by the different entities of the Society of Petroleum Engineers, like the Mid-Continent Section in Tulsa, by universities, by professional conferences like the Offshore Process Safety Conference, invited me as their keynote speaker. So they're searching for these answers. And one of the problems right now is, for example, the second half of BP's civil trial started only this past September 30th. So this is alive and well in the courts. And because it's alive and well in the courts, there are so many closed mouths that and closed doors and websites that I downloaded to do my research are no longer available online. You know, just from my perspective, I'm seeing a lot of interest out there to say, guys, we need to understand this to make sure that we need to know why it shouldn't have happened, why it should never happen again. And there are, in addition to that, regulatory SIMS, Safety and Environmental Management Systems, their drilling process safety and real-time data umbrella-type programs that when we look back at Macondo and we say, that little bitty blip on that little on this curve right here, you're saying, that's really significant. If you're the guy on the rig and you're looking at that and you don't see that as being important, well, maybe we need an umbrella-type system, a computer-driven umbrella-type system that would have zero problem catching that glitch and sending an alarm or a red light or a flag to say, hey, by the way, you better check this out.
John Turley, thanks very much for joining us.
You're very, very welcome.
John Turley is a retired petroleum engineer and energy executive and writer. He's the author of The Simple Truth, BP's Macondo Blowout, and he'll be giving the Hewlings Lecture Friday, November 15th at 6 o'clock at the Alan Chapman Activity Center on the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs or part of today's episode, you can listen online at publicradiotulsa.org. Simply find Studio Tulsa. You can search through our archives or listen to any show from our past. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.